Good evening. Welcome. My name is David Kramer, and I am the director of the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. It is our privilege to sponsor these book talks through, you know, over the course of the academic year. It's funny, we've had these book talks in this room before, primarily when we need a venue larger than one of our smaller meeting rooms. We often get, you know, 25, 30 people for these talks. When we have a distinguished book with a well-known faculty author, we get larger crowds, and so we often come into this room. And I've always neglected to draw attention to the fact that we are actually in what was once upon a time the library reading room. Right, so you know, for a library-sponsored book talk, it is very appropriate that it should take place here. Some of you may notice that even the decoration that's left from that time, if you go to the top of the stairway, there are a series of what are meant to be, you know, the spines of books. And if you read carefully afterwards, you'll find that it represents the canon of subjects that JTS was committed to studying, at least in its early years. So it's worth looking at carefully. In any case, we're here for David Rosky's a friend, a well-known scholar, a beloved teacher here at JTS. He's actually the only faculty member that I've ever had the privilege and pleasure of co-teaching a course with. In 2001, the fall of 2001, a course on catastrophe. Go figure. This evening, we're going to be hearing about a volume that focuses on the product of work seeking to resist at least the possible outcomes of another catastrophe, a world-shaking catastrophe, shaking many Jewish worlds and the world beyond. What it means to struggle to assure that our history will be told. And this volume, which is in translation selections of material that were preserved in the Oneg Shabbos archive, is for those of us who don't know it well, who don't study it as a discipline, really horizon opening. It's extraordinary the kinds of things that one learns from material preserved in a way that David will share with us. If you know about this or if you don't know about it, I can assure you that both what we will learn now and when you have occasion to read the book, you will find yourself in a topic that you think you know a lot about, learning far more than you ever knew you could. And so it is that promise I hold to you with this book talk, and I introduce my friend, Professor David Rosky.
Thank you so much for coming. So this coming Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. on the Discovery Channel, you will have the opportunity to see Roberta Grossman's new documentary, Who Will Write Our History? I strongly urge you to do so. Towards the end of this film, you will hear the words of Rochel Auerbach in voiceover, and here's what she says. The memories of those who survived are often as hurt and broken as their lives. That is why the most believable witness will be the written word from those years, which is now in the ruins under the Warsaw Ghetto. It's a very compact sentence, but in this sentence, Rochel Auerbach articulates the two poles of post-war Holocaust memory. Whose testimony is the more believable, the more credible, the more truthful, the more relevant? Whose testimony do we value more? Do we wish to impart to future generations? Will it be the written word from those years or the memories of those who survived? Will it be the written word or the spoken word? Will it be our history or will it be my story? Will it be our history recorded in wartime under German occupation as the experiences unfolded? Or will it be the experiences retold long after the fact in freedom and security? Will it be the story recorded in the very languages that they were speaking and hearing at the very moment? Or will it be memories in a borrowed tongue, in an acquired, newly adopted language? Will it be a story that was recorded in secret, preserved anonymously, or recorded in the presence of strangers in front of a video camera? Will it be the story of how we struggled and perished, or will it be the story of how I survived? Will it be a story that covers the cross-section of the Holocaust's first witnesses of all ages and social position, or will it be the story of the Holocaust's last witnesses, those few who somehow managed to survive? So which of these two rescue operations should command our attention, should inspire teachers, artists, spiritual leaders, publishers, podcasters, philanthropists? We know the answer. It will be video testimonies, because they have become the central vector of Holocaust memory, the essential rescue operation of our times, and really for all time to come. So Rochel Auerbach's voice calls on us to consider a different answer and to retrace our steps and revisit the path not taken. Who will write our history is the story of the Ringelblum Archive, code name Oinig Shabbos, and buried in three parts beneath the ruins of Warsaw. The fate of this archive and of those who created it is the storyline of the film. So I'm not going to go over that ground tonight. The Ringelblum Archive, if you will, is the part that stands for the whole, because other archival projects existed in Lodz, in Vilna, in Kovna, in Bialystok, in Terezin, and believe it or not, even in Auschwitz-Birkenau. Each was a heroic anthological project carried out in real time, against time, where the unit of memory was the entire community, polity, people, as they faced a catastrophe of unprecedented proportions. Now, the unique nature and fate of the Ringelblum Archive is what brings us here today. All the rescued documents have finally been cataloged, inventoried, and are now available online. The Jewish Historical Society in Warsaw, known as the JIH, that's the acronym, has completed the publication of the Ringelblum Archive in 37 volumes. 37 volumes, it's a facsimile edition with the Polish translation and scholarly apparatus into Polish. The first three volumes of a projected 12-volume English language abridged edition have already appeared. And I'm going to be doing a show and tell. So for those of you who are listening as on a podcast, you should know that I brought my library along, because this is a book talk, after all. So one should talk about books and show them and display them. So the publication of the actual physical archive is now, we have it. It's there. It's available to us. And I already mentioned, of course, Who Will Write Our History on the Discovery Channel, which will be screened on Sunday, because Sunday is the day before International Holocaust Day, January 27th. And finally, this book, Voices from the Warsaw Ghetto. Only now has the Ringelblum Archive finally become an open book. And now that it is an open book, we can take its full measure. And the verdict is in. The Ringelblum Archive, codename Oinig Shabbos, is the single most important corpus of wartime writing in any language. By design, it lays the foundation of Holocaust documentation for historians of the future. As it stands, even though not all of it was rescued, the Ringelblum Archive is an anthological masterpiece, a classic of Holocaust literature. It is written in the primary languages of the Holocaust, Yiddish, Polish, and classical Hebrew. It preserves the voices of the victims and witnesses themselves, sometimes firsthand, sometimes secondhand, sometimes written openly with absolute candor, sometimes written in code. So here is volume one of the 37-volume Polish facsimile edition. And it is dedicated to letters and postcards. So this whole volume is letters and postcards that made it to the Warsaw Ghetto, that were sent, and that somehow Ringelblum and his staff had the perspicacity to save and preserve. There were obviously exponentially more letters that were sent, but this is what survived. So the book opens on January 21st, 1942, with a postcard or letter from Rabbi Yankiv Shulman from the Grabov Ghetto, in which he reveals the fate of the entire Jewish populations of the surrounding shtetlach. They all ended up in a nearby camp where they were, this is what the letter says, annihilated by gaz. Menfargazeyet, mefargazeyet ze, und ze wären massenweis zu 50, 60 man begroben in a grub. They are being gassed and they are laid in mass graves, 50, 60 to a grave. What he's describing is the Chelmno death camp, which began the mass gassings in beginning of December 1941. So this is only a few weeks later. So what is to be done? Well, he doesn't know, he's the rabbi, so he's calling for a public fast, and he's appealing to the Jews of Warsaw to alarm the world. The last postcard or letter is written in Yiddish and in Polish from someone named Moshe Rosner in Sanz to his father-in-law. It's dated, it's very late, the 3rd of January, 1943. He reports that there is a voluntary registration of Jews to immigrate to Palestine. And in the letter he asks, is this some kind of diabolical trick or should we put our names down? So I just chose right from the beginning and the end two names, Yankiv Shulman and Moshe Rosner, two voices who would otherwise have been silenced forever. The Ringelblum Archive is the sound chamber of Polish Jewry, the collective voice of the Jewish heartland. So, I mentioned that three volumes of an abridged English edition. Well, each volume is like this. I have the first two, and it's exquisitely produced and very, very well translated by two teams of translators, one working from the Polish and another working from the Yiddish. So this is what it looks like, and I'm going to leave the books up here so that you can actually peruse them after my lecture. Just the table of contents, no more. It begins with a chapter called Images, which are kind of like vignettes drawn from all over the archive. It's in lieu of an overview. The next chapter is called Refugees and Deportees. Very important, there were 150,000 refugees flocking into, deported into the ghetto. They were the most vulnerable population. And you'll see them, actually film footage of this in the documentary, and a whole discussion of the plight of the refugees and deportees. A chapter devoted to house committees. What are they? House committees was the major form of grassroots organization, completely self-run. It was also the brainchild of Emanuel Ringelblum and was unique to the Warsaw Ghetto. The next chapter, on women. It is a revelatory chapter. A revelatory chapter because it describes the liberation and transformation and demoralization of Jewish women when men could no longer provide for them and for their family. The next chapter is about combating typhus. The height of the typhus epidemic was in the summer of 1941. 5,000 Jews were dying every month. If the ghetto had not been able to stem the epidemic, typhus alone would have solved the Jewish problem for the Germans. A chapter on economy and finances, everything from smuggling to matchmaking. A chapter on education, a chapter on Jews and Poles and assimilationists and converts, all under one rubric. You have to remember that under the Nuremberg laws, you had to, anyone three generations removed was still considered a Jew, and there was a church, and a Catholic church inside the ghetto, and practiced, and Jews, Catholic Jews, or former Jews, prayed there, right? It was their church. There's a chapter on Jews and Germans, which is mostly about prisoners, and it ends with two very controversial chapters, one on the Jewish Order Service, which is the name of the Jewish police, the first Jewish police force in the world outside of Palestine, Lahavdil, and the last is called the 13. This was a mafia unique to the Warsaw Ghetto. They were active collaborators with the Germans. It's the single most scandalous subject. So, what is the most salient feature of this table of contents? I think it's comprehensiveness. It provides a complete social tapestry from public health and education to criminal behavior and converts. It's a civilization in miniature, down to the most intimate and minute details. So, when have we last seen such a multi-volume compendium that leaves no aspect of Jewish life unstudied, that preserves multiple perspectives on every major topic, that subjects to analysis even the most unseemly aspects of urban life, the home, the bedroom, the street, the lice, the vice, the poverty? Yes, not since the Talmud. So let me put it to you. Emanuel Ringelblum was to the Onik Shabbos as Yehuda HaNasi was to the Mishnah. As Rabbi redacted the Mishnah in a time of persecution and change in order to avert the possibility that the oral traditions of the Pharisees would be forgotten, that's what Ringelblum did. He began to keep his own diary the moment the Warsaw fell to the Germans, and began to urge his fellow conspirators to do the same. Capture the moment, because tomorrow it will all be forgotten. Emanuel Ringelblum was to the Onik Shabbos as Rav Ashi was to the Talmud Bavli. He was the chief instigator, the coordinator, the architect, the arbiter, the editor. As the Talmud is for Rabbinic Judaism, so the Ringelblum archive is to the Shoah. By design, Ringelblum and his hand-picked staff set out to incorporate all genres of Holocaust literature and to cover all points on the Holocaust compass. So, where in this grand transhistorical scheme do I come in? Well, I think this brings me to my illustrious forebearer, Yehuda Ibn Chaviv, who was exiled from Spain in 1492, found temporary refuge in Portugal, and began compiling the Ein Yaakov in Salonika. So, the Ein Yaakov was an anthological compilation of the Agadic portions of the Talmud. It was a rescue operation in the face of total geographical and cultural upheaval. Well, as best as I could, I tried to rescue the Agadata, if you will, of the Ringelblum archive, which is to say, the works of artistic merit. And I tried to add a commentary and explanatory material when need be. Why does this matter? Why do we need the Agadata? Why do we need the Agadah? Because we're also interested in not just the facts, but the meaning of the facts. Not only establishing the historical veracity of events, but hearing the multiplicity of voices, preserving the multilingualism, the dialects, the spoken languages, the idioms, the jokes, the argo, the whole social panorama. So, in the time that remains, what I would like to do is to propose two different ways of reading this book, two different entry points. Let me call the first a Talmudic approach to this material, and the other I will call sequential, or I call it reading in time. And let me say at the outset that neither the Talmudic nor the sequential method of reading can be used to look at video testimonies, which require a whole different hermeneutic, a whole different vocabulary, a whole different set of disciplines. So, what would the classical Talmudic approach be? The book begins with a synoptic essay written by Ringelblum himself after the first January uprising, the first act of armed resistance in the ghetto, which was in January of 1943. The second part of the archive was buried a month later, and it included that this chapter. And if any of you has seen either of the milk canisters, can I see a show of hands of those of you who have seen either the one at the in Washington, or the other one is now in the Jewish Historical Society in Warsaw? It is worth a pilgrimage to see the milk canister in which the archive was kept. It is really a sacred object, no question. So I would compare it heuristically, this opening chapter, to the Mishnah, because every paragraph, every topic, every author that he summarizes refers to something that appears or is expanded upon somewhere in the archive, or that Ringelblum wished he could have expanded upon. So it's all already there in a very compact form, and that's why I chose to begin with that. So one can profitably begin at the beginning and follow each of these references wherever it takes you. So he mentions, for example, the house committees, and singles out for praise the work of one of his co-workers, Peretz Opochinsky. So the book contains a chapter called House Number 21, which is a reportage of one of the house committees, and it happened to be the place where Opochinsky himself lived. If that's not enough, there is a whole book that has come out called In Those Nightmarish Days, the Ghetto Reportage of Peretz Opochinsky from the Warsaw Ghetto, and Yosef Zelkovich from the Lodz ghetto. So obviously it's the beginning of a much larger work. One of his most trusted co-workers was Rabbi Shimon Huberband. He was responsible for chronicling the life of Orthodox, of the religious life in the ghetto, but he did much more than that. And what we've included is this collection of ghetto folklore: signs of the Messiah, legends, jokes, and puns. But there is also this book, Kiddush Hashem, Jewish Religious and Cultural Life in Poland During the Holocaust, the collected writings of Shimon Huberband, edited by our own colleague, David Fishman. So you see where I'm going with this. What this book is, just a drop in the bucket, but there's so much more, and much of it is already available. There is the diary of Abraham Levin, which I will tell you more about in a few minutes. Well, this is the whole diary. It was published a number of years ago. A Cup of Tears, a Diary of the Warsaw Ghetto. And why this is so important, I'll explain in a bit. And finally, on Ringelblum's wish list was Chaim Kaplan's diary. So here's what he has to say about Chaim Kaplan's diary. The diary of the Hebrew writer and teacher Chaim Aaron Kaplan, written in Hebrew, amounted to thousands of pages and contained a mass of information about what happened each day in Warsaw. Kaplan was not a man of broad interests, but the experience of every ordinary Warsaw Jew, his sufferings and feelings, his thirst for revenge, all are faithfully conveyed in Kaplan's diary. It is precisely the ordinariness of the writer that makes the diary important. I asked Kaplan more than once to give his manuscript up to the archive on the guarantee that it would be returned to him after the war. Most reluctantly, he was persuaded to let us copy the manuscript, but this was very difficult. A part remains in the Onyx Shabbos archive. The complete manuscript was lost during the deportation, together with the author, who was taken to the Umschlagplatz. He doesn't know that Kaplan, during the deportations, managed to give his precious diary to a Christian Pole who kept it, and we have his diaries. They did survive. They did survive. So what I'm saying is that, as in the Mishnah, every single perek opens up into a separate masechta. And it goes on and on. One could also approach this philologically, because one needs to pay close attention to every word, no matter how mundane or prosaic. So here's a poem, or the beginning of a poem, by one of the major poets of the ghetto, Władysław Szlengel. And it's called Telephone. The speaker in this poem is just an ordinary ghetto dweller with powerful emotional ties to the other side. And the silent telephone is an emblem of separation and loss. So these are the first four stanzas, the only ones that I included here. With my heart broken and sick, with my thoughts on the other side, I was sitting one evening next to the telephone. And I think, let me ring someone on the other side when I am on telephone duty in the evening. And suddenly I realize, my God, there is actually no one to call. In 1939, I went on a different road. Our ways have parted, friendships sunk to the bottom, and now, well, there's no one I can telephone. So you get the gist of it, but I was responsible as editor to explain everything in this poem, and I came upon this, I am on telephone duty. What does that mean? So I asked the experts, and the first person I called was Sam Castle, my colleague, and he said, well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that he was a member of the Jewish police, and in the police office, they must have had a phone, and he was on phone duty. And this is kind of controversial, that he was a member of the Jewish police force. Okay, so I was just about to write that as the footnote, but I asked a few more people, and it turns out that there were buildings that had working telephones, but there was only one phone per building, and they did a rotation, an hourly or, you know, and he's on rotation duty in 1940, waiting to receive a call or to place a call, but there's nobody to call. Who's he going to call now? Who's going to pick up the phone to him that from inside the ghetto? Telephone duty. There's another amazing section from a literary point of view, the most accomplished literary work that's in this collection and probably in the entire archive. It's called Chronicle of a Single Day by Leib Golden. And it's the 24 hours in the life of a starving ghetto intellectual who calls himself Arke, but his biography is very similar to that of the author. And He can't get his mind off of food. And he walks out into the street at a certain point, and he sees bread, which he can't afford to buy. And he goes into this reverie of bread, and he mentions this kind of bread, and that kind of bread, and this kind of bread. And these words were nowhere to be found, in no dictionary. So what does one do? Well, when I was working on this, this was a number of years ago, we're talking the mid-80s, 1986, there was still a baker I could call who had been a baker in Warsaw. And he told me what the breads were, and we did the best we could to approximate this in the translation. Today, I don't think there would have been anyone to ask, frankly. There is a work here called Yisker, 1943, which chronicles the Promethean struggle of Rochel Auerbach between personal and collective memory, between the need and impossibility of remembering. She wrote it on the first anniversary of the Great Deportation. It exists in three languages. She originally wrote it in Polish, then she translated it after the war into Hebrew. The version I was working with was the last version, her own translation into Yiddish. It appeared on the 20th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in Die Goldene Kate, which is the major, was then the major literary publication in Yiddish. Edited by a great editor and poet, Avrom Sutzkever. He came to the word, to a phrase. Where are you petty thieves of Warsaw? You illegal street vendors and sellers of rotten apples. But the word that she used for illegal street vendors was chesedlach. And she wanted that word to be preserved because in the Polish, she romanizes it as chesedlach, and in the Hebrew translation, she vocalizes it as chesedlach. But Avrom Sutzkever was a Litvak. He never heard this word, and he corrected it. And he changed it to chosidlach, little chasidim. And that's the version that I had. Chosidlach. And it made no sense. It didn't make sense to me. I was working with a wonderful translator, Leonard Wolf. What could this possibly be? I didn't have the Polish version then, and I didn't actually I didn't know about the Hebrew translation. All I had was the Yiddish. Well, it turns out that in another work from the ghetto by Peretz Opochinski called Smuggling in the Warsaw Ghetto, he uses that term chesedlach and he defines it as sellers of rotten apples. It's a word that existed only on the streets of Warsaw, chesedlach. So the philology is extremely important. Every word is a story, you see. A Talmudic reading abhors abstraction. It values the most mundane aspects of daily life, like daydreaming next to a silent telephone. It knows the difference between chesedlach and chosedlach. And it also pays close attention to matters of translation. So why did I commission a new translation of Kaplan's Scroll of Agony, when one was already readily available, and an augmented translation had already come out in paperback by the time I was working on this material. Here is why. This is from the end of the entry on November 13th, 1941. Kaplan writes, this is in the translation by Abraham Koch, who also published the Hebrew. My brain is busy with one thing. Whence cometh my help? I try to think of the objects of value remaining in my possession that could be sold. During the 2 years of war, almost everything I had was sold in order to escape starvation. Death is lurking at the patient's side, and one suppresses all feelings of sentiment toward even the most cherished thing. The patient is his wife who's dying, and there's nothing he can do about it. So Katz was working with a certain tradition of translation. He wanted to achieve fluency. He wanted a streamlined translation, no stylistic frills. He also eliminated almost all the biblical citations. Chaim Kaplan was a teacher of Tanakh. He was a Hebrew educator. There are almost no footnotes or annotations. Okay, here is the same selection in Jeffrey Green's translation. My brain teems with but a single thought. Whence will come my aid? It plots stratagems for finding money. What valuable thing remains in my possession that I can sell and get some decent sum for? During the 2 years of the war, my possessions have become almost completely depleted. One by one, I have sold them to evade the disgrace of hunger. With a sinking heart, I removed them from my house and accepted mere pennies for them. For woe to man and object when there is need or necessity to bring it out to the marketplace for sale. Bad, bad, says the buyer, valuing it 7 times less than what you reckoned while you sat at home. With pain in your heart, you place the beloved object in a stranger's hands, and in return you receive a few crumpled bills which bring you slight relief for a few days. For in the meanwhile, the prices have soared and the money melts away between your fingers. But there's no choice. The danger of death lurks at the head of the patient's bed. At moments like that, you repress all kinds of sentiments. But before my weary brain can labor and choose some object, a dark, cloudy autumn night spreads its wings over the ghetto dwellers. With evening comes darkness, and the ghetto then becomes a city of madmen and lunatics. The darkness is double. No light outside for fear of air attack. The gas lamps are not lit. Shop windows are extinguished. Shutters are sealed over doors. Quite simply, as it is written in Exodus 10:21, a darkness that can be touched. Inside the house, there is no spark of light. At midnight, the electric current is cut off, and a watery tallow candle that melts and drips replaces it. To go out at night in darkness such as that is to risk mortal danger. People collide and crash into each other, and they are left wounded and bruised. This is no time to settle your affairs, whether buying or selling. You must put everything off till morning light. By the dim light of the candle, the night shadows thicken. You are completely sunk in thoughts and shadows. The silence of the ghetto in the darkness increases the fear of night, full of secrets and hints. In my room, there is no living being except the patient with her burning fever and death lying in wait for her. So, this is another writer. This is entirely a different voice. My goodness. So, the translation is much more scholastic. It's slightly bookish. It's a more elevated diction, but that's the way he wrote Hebrew. He wrote this kind of Achada Ami in Hebrew. And the Tanakh is everywhere. The diary was his life. It was his literary legacy. He has a fine eye for novelistic detail. How they sold their precious belongings. How the darkness of the ghetto night is different from all other darknesses. And the quotations he uses are from the ninth plague, Vayhi Choshech al Eretz Mitzrayim, Vayimash Choshech. So that's the first phrase. It's palpable. You can feel it. And he ends with the most terrifying words from the Tochacha, from the Mosaic curses. Baboker tomar mi yitain erev, uva erev tomar mi yitain boker. That is my life. Why does he use biblical languages, phrases? What is he doing here? Why is he seeking biblical precedent for his experience? Because Kaplan is living in a sense that he is living in archetypal time. He is living something comparable to the biblical narrative. And that's one of the ways that he can underscore his particular sensibility. So, a Talmudic reading is one that distinguishes each voice in its special cadence, diction, sensibility, and perception of time. So that's one approach. The book, however, is organized in a different way, and I call this method reading in time. It's what no video testimony can provide. It's what only great literature can provide, like reading Thomas Mann or Marcel Proust. That is the slow, sequential flow of time. And I have to admit that the movie doesn't do that because it's too compressed. It compresses all the war into an hour and a half. Everything has to move very, very quickly. That's just the nature of it. So, Voices from the Warsaw Ghetto begins with a timeline, which actually tells its own story because it mixes and matches great historical events with the life and death of the ghetto. And I think that as one reads, it's very useful to flip back to the beginning to see what else is going on in that year or in those months. So one of the great aspects of time that you are able to experience is durational time, because they are in the ghetto for years and years. He just mentioned 2 years have already passed. It's right in his own diary. He says, I've already been here for 2 years. How do you convey that sense, that durational, the slowness of it? So I've already singled out a chronicle of a single day, that masterpiece of psychological prose. We know almost nothing about the author, Leib Golden. He was obviously extremely well-read in Yiddish and European classics. As I said, what he does is he captures 24 lives, 24 hours in the life of a starving intellectual. The passage I'm going to read to you, it's still early in the morning. He's waiting for his daily soup, which he will eat at 20 minutes to 1. But he has to kill time. And the only way he can think of doing that is by reading. So he's thinking about how they will, when he reaches the soup kitchen, how the soup will be eaten. Maybe it will already have been poured. Oh, how magnificently Thomas Mann describes it in The Magic Mountain. I remember his thoughts, the way he delineated them. Never has their brilliant truth appeared so clear to me as it does now. Time and time. Now it stretches like rubber, and then it's gone like a dream, like smoke. Right now, of course, it's stretched out horribly, horribly. It's really enough to kill you. The war has been going on for a full 2 years, and you've eaten nothing but soup for some 4 months. And those few months are thousands and thousands of times longer for you than the whole of the previous 20 months. No, longer than your whole life until now. So, can literature begin to capture what hunger really feels like? And the answer is yes. And you will see it on Sunday, because Leib Golden's story is brought to life by a brilliant Polish actor who went on a starvation diet for 3 months in order to play the role of Arka. But durational time is only one piece of it. Then there is time before and time after, which is the major demarcation of Holocaust time. This book spans three time periods. One is the beginning of the German occupation from the 1st of October 39 until the middle of November 1940. Then the establishment of the ghetto. On the 16th of November, the ghetto was sealed off, 1940, until July 21st, 1941. 1942, the beginning of the Great Deportation. That was the annihilation, the Holocaust. There were 300,000 Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. In the course of 6 weeks, 275,000 were shipped off in trains to Treblinka. And it's during this period that the work of the archive comes almost to a complete standstill. The first part is buried on August 3rd, 1942, because they don't know if anyone is going to survive at all. And then there is a brief reprieve. The second part of the archive will be buried in February. The third part of the archive, which documents the uprising, is buried in the very midst of the uprising in April of 1943. That part was never discovered. We know where it is, but it cannot be recovered. So this sense of time breaking in two is amply evidenced in this. We have the last wills of Israel Lichtenstein, his wife Gela Seckstein, the artist. We have her 300 of her drawings were buried in the first part of the archive, and she just managed to write her last testament and bury it together with her drawings. There are a few reproductions in here. In terms of my reading, the most dramatic text of all is Abraham Levin, because to mark time before and time after, he changes languages. The first part of the archive is written in Yiddish, the living language of East European Jewry. Once the Great Deportation begins, he switches to Hebrew. Is it for clandestine reasons, or is it because he understood that he was entering into a whole new moment in history and that he needed to write in the language of Jewish eternity? Did he know that Yiddish-speaking Jewry would perhaps not even survive? Whatever it was, he changes languages and goes on writing. So there are two different diaries in one. One is his personal diary, and then the last is the day-by-day chronicle of the Great Deportation. You feel the change in the poetry of Schlengel. We began with this very urbane, understated poem. The later poetry, different poet. He has a poem here called Counterattack, call for revenge, a call celebrating the first act of armed resistance. And another poem called Things, which is apocalyptic, because the only thing left to bear witness to the Jews of Poland are the things that they left behind. So what you actually see when you read this literature in sequential order is the birth of an archetype, which we now call Shoah. And those who lived long enough saw it, described it, and wrote about it. So what happened? What happened to this extraordinary corpus of wartime writing from the ghettos? Why was it consigned to oblivion? Why was it marginalized and atomized, boulderized? Boulderized is a fancy word for censored, expurgated. So here's what my friend and colleague, Sam Casso, says. Perle, Auerbach, Opochinsky, Schlengel, why did so many years have to pass before they were translated and read? One reason was that post-war Jewish communal memory of the Holocaust was more interested in stirring narratives of armed resistance or mournful narratives of mass martyrdom than it was in accurate history. It was far from easy to face the nuanced and complex net legacy of an archive that tried to convey Jewish life as it really was and in all its complexity. So much of the material collected by Oneg Shabbos seemed in retrospect to be too prosaic or too controversial or too painful. Who really cared about soup kitchens, jokes, or courtyards in the Warsaw Ghetto? Who wanted to confront Jewish rage against other Jews or the sordid story of the Jewish police in the Warsaw Ghetto? If wartime Jewish writing registered Jewish anger and fury leveled against other Jews, after the war, Jews preferred to forget this and think about the fighters. In Israel, the new Jewish state heralded the saga of armed resistance in the ghettos and forests as a salvation of Jewish honor and as a fundamental link in a historical chain that led from exile to sovereignty. So it was too scandalous, it was too complicated, it was too politically incorrect. Or let me ask the question this way. Why has the Onik Shabbos not shared the fate of the Talmud? Because Babylonian Jewry was never annihilated. Babel was not rendered Judenrein. Aramaic was not forgotten. Rabbinic culture beat out the competition and became our civilizational norm. What Sam Castle doesn't want to say is what we know to be true, and that is that Hitler did win the war against the Jews. The civilization of Ashkenaz was utterly destroyed, and its surviving culture bearers were dispersed. Polish ceased to be the language of Jewish self-expression, or a language of Jewish self-expression, and Yiddish was abandoned to make way for other languages, for English, Spanish, Hebrew. But despite these overwhelming obstacles and catastrophic setbacks, the Ringelblum Archive has borne out Auerbach's prophecy. The written word from those years is slowly beginning to occupy its rightful place alongside the memories of those who survived. Our history is being studied alongside my story. Anyway, think how long it took for the Talmud to have Rashi and Steinsaltz. So we now are beginning to have a Sanchino edition of the Onik Shabbos, if you will. And some of the Tanaim and Amoraim have been brought to the silver screen. And there is the example of Yaakov Ibn Chaviv, thanks to whose inspiration we now have a portal to the agadic treasures of Onik Shabbos. For me, this is a paradigm shift. It is a significant moment in Jewish time, when the individual and collective voices of the Holocaust's first witnesses are being heard as never before. Thank you very much.
As you can see from the setup, we had imagined that I would begin by asking a question or two and then open up to you, but your questions are more important than mine. And so, David, while you take a little drink of something, you can then take observations or questions from the audience. Please, if you have any questions.
Ah, okay. Since I did throw it out, it's a good question. It's buried underneath the Chinese embassy. That's the most educated guess that we have. No one's going to blow up the Chinese embassy in order to unearth it. And what's more, we probably have duplicates of most of what was buried, because what I neglected to say is that the youth movements, the political underground, maintained their own archives. Dror Hechalutz had its own archive. Shomer HaTzair had its own archive. The Bund had its own archive. The revisionists, and they were able to retrieve their own writings. So we're guessing that most of what's in that last part are calls to arms and things that were written by the Jewish combat organization. And some of the fighters, like Zivia Lubetkin and Antek Zuckerman, did survive. So we have their story. That's part three. The other two parts, we would never have been able to replicate in any way, shape, or form, ever.
I don't know what it was. It was a book that in my...
Well, two volumes of Ringelblum's writings were published. The first is the diary, and the second are his essays in Yiddish and translated into Polish. But if you Google Notes from the Warsaw Ghetto by Emanuel Ringelblum, you'll see that such a book exists. It's a Reader's Digest. It's politically censored. It's a product of the Stalinist period of the 1950s, and it should never have been translated. It should never have appeared in this way. But since such a book exists, we don't have a real scholarly edition in English of Ringelblum yet. It's only, you know, coming out seriatim through this new series. Yes. It's much more legible now that UNESCO has acknowledged this as one of the great cultural treasures of Western civilization, and a lot of money was poured in, also by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. But believe me, the material was, there was ample material available for decades and decades. But I think you're right. It's a process. And the survivors needed to tell their own story. That needed to be done, and it had to be done sooner rather than later. So we've come to the end of that chapter, and that's why we're in a much better position now. There's a confluence of reasons why I think we are now finally ready to read this and understand it and appreciate it.
The question is, who does he hope will read the book?
My utopian dream is a Daf Yomi. Daf Yomi. I think it would take about 7 years to go through it all. I would need a chevrusa to do this. Listen, I have to admit to you, I am not I'm a cultural historian, and I do not read Polish. So I am missing one of the basic tools. If I had my life to live over again, and I knew then what I know now, that one could easily devote a life to this, I would have retrained and retooled in a totally different way. So it's that kind of work that requires discipline and a cadre of people who are going to say, we want to read. Let's say when all 12 volumes of this appear in English, a study group that would devote 5 years to reading it, something like that. I would like to see something like that happen. But of course, it'll reverberate in so many different ways. The chapter on women, I mean, there's a great deal of interest, yes, on how women coped in adversity and during the Holocaust. Many books on this subject. Most of them focus on the concentration camps. And here you have pages and pages of portraits of women and how they changed their lives in the ghetto, written by very sophisticated writers, I mean, professional writers, social workers. This is inexhaustible. Many books, movies can come out of this.
David, I just I want to thank you and just say that, you know, the choices you've made, the agadata that you've chosen, you know, even for those of us who are, as lay people, relatively well-educated in this, open windows to stories and to perspectives and to experiences that very few of us appreciate before we dive into this material. So I want to recommend it to all of you. I also have to say that the film, which will be on Sunday on the Discovery Channel, you said, is, you know, very different than what you'll read, but also very, very important and should be very highly recommended. As you have, you've analogized this work to the Talmud. I'm pleased to say, as a Talmudist, that I consider the image of the Talmud to be very important. And it just so happens that next month, the Library Book Talk, on February 25th, will be devoted to a book called A History of the Talmud by someone named David Kramer. So we invite you to come back for that. There are copies of this book that are available for purchase, $20 per volume. $20 bills or 2 times 10 or something like that is appreciated. We'll accept a check. If you're purchasing by check, please make it out to me because I actually put the purchase of the books on my own tab. But David will be out here signing books, selling books, and an anonymous friend has also made available refreshments for all of you. So please feel free to go left or right to purchase a book and to have a conversation. And thank you very much for coming.
Okay.